I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Christopher Nolan is an author, artist, and criminal lawyer. He joins me now to talk about his new book, Tough Tiddlywinks. It's an illustrated crime thriller, and it's set in Vancouver. In 2008, just after the economic crash, a Vancouver real estate developer, Condo King Donald Dickerson, is killed. He's been buying up the city, and there are many suspects. A First Nations man named Brian Ghostkeeper is found with a knife and tried for the murder. I'll get Mr. Nolan to fill in the rest and tell us about the book's inspiration. I'll also ask him about the Vancouver depicted in this book and what the book might say about the activist community here, the schism between them and business interests, development, politics, and the law. Christopher Nolan teaches law at Langara College, and his book, Judging Obscenity, A Critical History of Expert Evidence, was nominated for the Shaughnessy Cohen Prize for Political Writing in 2003, while his first novel, To See the Sky, was published in 2007. The book is liberally illustrated with Mr. Nolan's work. More can be had at his website, christophernolan.com. The book is published by A Picture's Worth Press. You can buy it from, among other places, Pulp Fiction Books on Main, just north of Broadway. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Christopher Nolan. Mr. Nolan, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When did you live in England?
I lived in England from 2000 through the summer of 2001. I went there on a teaching contract to teach law at Keele University.
I see. And so is that where you began to paint?
It is, actually. Having that nice university job, when the summer came around, I didn't have much to do, and I was still getting a paycheck, I mean, apart from your regular academic research. But I lived in a small, really charming little town called Newcastle-under-Lyme, very picturesque, with cobblestone streets and all that. I love surrealist painting, and dreams are very surrealistic, and I had a crazy one evening, and I woke up and I thought, I'll try to paint it or try to draw it. I'd never painted before, and I really thought, well, it's a nice summer day. I'll go down to the art store. I went and bought some paper and some like basic acrylic paints or whatever, and I drew this thing out of this image of a man in a kind of a town, kind of a store, like a department store, lying there larger than life and the townspeople bustling about. And it took me some time, but I did end up eventually painting it and kind of framing it and taking it back with me in the fall for the next part of my teaching. And my colleagues kind of commented on it and said, "Where did I get that?" And I said, "I made it." And they all encouraged me to do more. And that began my painting.
So you were never artistic growing up or anything like that?
I always had a tendency to wish to draw and those kind of things. And I definitely had a, you know, on some level, I never had any formal or professional aspirations to draw, but I was, I think, visually, in terms of the visual arts and drawing and that kind of thing, very inclined to that. I just never really pursued it. I kind of pursued a more academic type of, life as I kind of got past university and all that. I really did originally wish to be an architect when I was younger, and I simply never pursued that after taking some engineering courses and stuff like that, and I drifted into philosophy. Really enjoying that and finding I had an aptitude for that. And that's really probably when my kind of handwork I would have done with drawing went by the wayside. But with my painting and drawing style today, that architectural interest of mine definitely seeps in.
Was it important for you to write this novel, Tough Tiddlywinks, and have it illustrated at the same time?
Not so much at first. My first inspiration for it was more of an intellectual, kind of more cerebral motivation. But I had longed. I mean, I think over the years, I had such a fondness for the combination of text and imagery in other artists' work that the idea was always in the back of my mind, I guess, in a way that, you know, that's something that I could do. I just didn't really believe in it as a kind of a project until kind of later on in the story, when I was kind of felt that I had the story done, and then I thought, you know, maybe, you know, graphic novels were kind of emerging and becoming even increasingly more popular, and I thought maybe I could do something even a little bit kind of hybrid that way. I certainly wasn't going to attempt to write a graphic, turn my novel into a graphic novel, but I thought, could I kind of go beyond the traditional, you know, the old Dickensian type of story where you have maybe a dozen, you know, illustrations in a book like that, and just full on, you know, illustrate it as I wished, like with my different style of art, and just, I didn't have a plan for that. I thought, you know, let's just see what I can do if I start to kind of create physically some characters, but also make kind of like little paintings and stuff like that. And eventually I just really pursued it on that level.
Yeah, and it works, doesn't it? I mean, I've only read a bit of it, but I mean, I've looked through it, and it seems to fill in a lot of the writing that you know, one reads.
I think it does, and I mean, I really do think it's a very distinctive project in that sense, that I think it really does kind of bridge, you know, kind of the old traditional type of adult illustrated book, like I say, with a few drawings, and the kind of current, you know, very heavily kind of cartooned or graphic book. So I think it does really, really work. I think every few pages or so, the reader gets a different style of drawing, and some of them are meant to be a little bit kind of politically clever, some are kind of more literal. But yes, I didn't give myself any rules in terms of what the illustrations would be like.
I sort of started to explain what the book is in my introduction, but I guess the best question for the author is to I mean, because, you know, you don't want to give away what happens in the book, because then people listening just won't pick it up.
Yes.
We'd like them to pick it up. So I guess the best thing for you as the author to do is to sort of explain to us what you wanted to portray in the book. I mean, it seemed to me, in reading as much as I've read of it, that you wanted to say something about Vancouver, where it was, say, a few years ago in the recent past, but also, you know, where we are today almost.
Sure, yeah, and you're absolutely right, and kind of going back to your intro, making the point about how there is aspects of, I mean, I guess certain comments in relation to Vancouver about it, like I was originally inspired to write a kind of about a kind of a North American culture of leveraging, like of the way that when I looked at how kind of when I looked back to the American kind of the Great Recession, so to speak, late 2007 into 2008, you know, the banks were blamed for a lot of that stuff and all this derivative and subprime stuff. But I'm quite interested in how we, the consumers, we, the kind of the people that are, say, buying real estate, et cetera, are prepared to kind of put ourselves up there with some risk. And then when the risk kind of goes against us, we find ourselves complaining. And so Vancouver is a place to me that is just prototypically about real estate. I mean, if there's, when I think about the other cities I've lived in across Canada, east and west, I've never really lived in one that just seems to be kind of prototypically about real estate, the real estate market, the sales, the costs, you know, the expense, the mortgaging, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of fit nicely in terms of a place to tell a story for me about what happens when we kind of get into this leveraging and this type of thing. And so yes, it was a nice it's a nice kind of city metaphorically for what I wanted to do, but also, I'm a really cycling enthusiast, and not on any major level, but I've always felt that the kind of, there's a major kind of conflict kind of in Vancouver between the kind of the vehicle community and the bikers community. There's a very vocal and kind of visible bicyclers presence in Vancouver, and they seem to be kind of in a small W. There always seems to be a small W war with the car
mm-hmm.
or truck, and I wanted to write about that. Yes.
Well, you know, talking about cycling for just a sec, you know, like, I don't drive and I don't cycle.
Yes.
But I talk to people that do drive, and they always complain about these bike lanes that we see
yes.
throughout the city, about how at any given time, I was on the Burrard Bridge or something like that, and there was no cyclist on the path or anything like
yes.
that. I mean, that's a lot. That's overplayed, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I agree, like, and if I understand you correctly, in the sense that, like, Vancouver's also a really rainy city, so
yeah.
So I always, like, even as, say, a cyclist myself, I'm not a big cyclist in the winter. I don't feel like getting soaking wet, and I'm not going to, you know, pull my bike over Burrard every day and back or something for that. So I'm not somebody who, like, you know, I guess I have my own kind of questions about bike lanes. I think for me, what it is there is that safety aspect of bike lanes is valid to me. There is something fairly dangerous about biking on Vancouver's streets, and I don't say this even, like, I'm not going to say, oh, it's because cars are overly aggressive. It's not so much that. I think cars themselves are a little bit unsure of what to do with when they've got a cyclist kind of on the corner on their right or something like that. I just, what it is it's just, you know, Vancouver's a heavily trafficked city, urban space. Bikes are not allowed to be on the sidewalks, fair enough. So they've got these little lanes, these tiny lanes, and they're just kind of inherently dangerous. A car can open a door at any point. Mm-hmm. You got turning. So that's why I'm a supporter of bike lanes for that safety reason mainly.
Yeah, but you know, then it opens up these other conversations. You know, if you drive a car, you automatically, you know, you're painted as someone who doesn't care about the environment. If you cycle, you're automatically, you know, considered like a tree hugger, sort of green type,
right?
You know, and I mean, it becomes reductive, doesn't it? The discussion.
Yeah, it does. And I don't want to present it. What I do is I kind of, in my story, mm-hmm. I present those kind of polar. I present that polarity, but I definitely, in terms of the way the novel plays out, I try to show that you know, that polarity needs to be like, if what you're saying needs to be kind of addressed more critically.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Like I certainly would hope that my story doesn't come across as, you know, kind of one sided in that sense. There's all kinds of reasons we need vehicles. I wouldn't suggest that for a moment. I'm trying to kind of show that on some level cyclists do need a kind of a safe avenue in that sense, so, figuratively speaking.
So the city that you that we live in, that's also in this book, is one that's whether we like it or not. I mean, it is pretty divided in terms of what one thinks or sort of the worldview that one has. You know, you mentioned earlier that we've been obsessed with real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, but that goes back, you know, 100 years or more, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So where do we go from here? I mean, as someone who's taken the time to write about this in a novel.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a lot of real life in it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where do you see us going?
Well, I think, you know, if I had to get kind of, you know, practical in terms of if I had to kind of put on some kind of municipal politician's hat in this regard, and is I'm somebody who sees our expansionist, in terms of outward expansionist, you know, tendencies as being potentially problematic, and so probably to the surprise of some people who know me or familiar with my, you know, my kind of ecological sensibility is I'm somebody that thinks we maybe do need more, like more density, for example, in the inner part of the city, to kind of minimize, if that's the best word, to some extent, the use of vehicle transportation and that kind of thing. Like where I'm kind of coming from, and there's this aspect of Detroit in my story that kind of keeps popping up, but it's done purposely so, which is that I see Detroit as a kind of an absolutely, like, beautiful metaphor for a city that emerged from a tiny little fort to becoming, you know, symbolic and then realistically the kind of motor city of America, and now essentially having kind of, like, disintegrating and trying to kind of find itself figuratively in a new forest and getting smaller and smaller and kind of exploring with green space. If it comes to Vancouver, for example, when we have all these issues like the twinning of the bridge, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. I'm somebody that's like, you know, we are going that way. We are still kind of, we're in terms of our regional planning, we're still kind of accommodating on an increasing vehicular market. And is there not things that we could be doing simply to kind of minimize that to some extent? And like saying, if that meant, for example, building higher condos or higher, then even though I'm having a lot of fun with that in my story, I'm certainly kind of trying to raise the point that, you know, that's something that is maybe is just something that's necessary. As more and more people come here, it may be less environmentally deleterious, for example, than, you know, outward, a kind of suburban expansion, that type of thing, if that kind of answers your question.
Yeah. And do people ask you about the characters in the book and if they're modeled after, say, real people?
You do get that, but I mean, because my book is so fresh right now and literally kind of off the press, I haven't had that many queries, but I get that, and those type of questions. And they, I mean, the answer that is the fair answer is, I mean, I guess I observe Vancouver politics as much as anyone else does, and I just create these, you know, characters that kind of have, I guess, little bits and pieces of all kinds of real life characters, but they're still ultimately in your imagination. I mean, I could just pick a character like Cactus or whatever it might be, and I've never met a Cactus. I've never met Don Dickerson, you know. But yes, I've pulled, you know, probably characters from other people I know together to make those people.
So, as I said in the introduction, Don Dickerson is a sleazy real estate developer.
Yeah.
What's he like?
So, within the story?
Yeah. So, I guess he's murdered soon after the story.
Yeah.
Begins, right?
So, what he's like is I've just made him a very kind of opportunistic in terms of his business, you know, buying real estate, you know, a little bit past, say, middle age, living life large and comfortably, and he's married this blonde. shouldn't be that way, but blonde. But he's married this lady that seems to suit his interests. They both like tennis, this kind of thing. They both like his yacht, and that she also likes the good life and the social life, I guess, that comes with it. But eventually he just gets his eyes on his eyes turn on a real very beautiful younger woman at a New Year's party, and it just gets him he goes a little bit crazy in that sense, and seeking this young woman's affections, and mm-hmm. I'm keeping him a somewhat, you know, a simple character because he isn't around for long, as you pointed out. But yeah, I'm just trying to show him as a person who is like almost enjoying the trading of real estate for the sake of it and for investment purposes, just in that regard.
Which is something that we've seen through the city. We've seen people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'm sure that there might be the odd reader of my story who's going to suggest that I'm linking him directly to some, there are notable, condominiums, tycoons in mm-hmm. Vancouver, but I certainly don't have any of them specifically in mind by any means.
So these characters, I mean, are there specific people that they inspire? I mean, like Slim Jimmy or Ryan Ghostkeeper? I mean,
Ryan Ghostkeeper is a pretty important character to me in the sense that I have represented many, many First Nations people as a criminal lawyer, and I have represented some for murder, and not just through my kind of my cases of murder, but through many of my other files with First Nations people, I've come to really genuinely recognize social, really genuine social economic difficulties and challenges some of these First Nations people face, and when I wrote this story, I didn't want to kind of somehow make a racial, kind of stereotype or anything like that. So I walked a fine line between trying to show the problems with First Nations accused persons that I have seen, and I'm saying they are very distinctive challenges, but at the same time, kind of make Ryan also resilient and not so mindful of his race, and not so much kind of a like that, just fitting into society as he may, but. So I've tried to bring to light for Canadians, like these are some of the real issues that First Nations people face in terms of the criminal justice system, but at the same time make him a real and somewhat resilient person. As I should say, in my experience as a lawyer, many First Nations people are. I've been amazed at some of the plight, some of the kind of physical health, emotional, substance addicted plight of some of these First Nations individuals, and yet their resilience is just amazing.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that we don't, most of us don't realize. We go to the stereotype, we go to the sort of the experience that we've known.
Yes.
Rather than say, figure out that like all people, the Native experience is rather nuanced.
Yeah, and well, that's absolutely right. It's nuanced, but it's also like if I can say that. When I went to law school in Ottawa, one invariably, when you study criminal law, you learn statistically about, say, you learn these things like First Nations overrepresentation in prison, mm-hmm. overrepresentation in crime, and until you kind of see that or live in a community where you see that firsthand or secondhand even, they are statistics that, you know, maybe should be concerning, but they're still, it's still an abstraction. And I had, it wasn't until I took the experience of taking over a practice for somebody temporarily in southern Alberta where I came kind of really firsthand, got a firsthand experience with representing many, many, many First Nations with heavy, heavy substance addiction problems and serious, getting charged with serious violent offenses, seeing those kind of suicide rate issue kind of things like right before your eyes. And it really hits home hard. And I've since seen similar kinds of situations like that in British Columbia, but nothing like I saw in southern Alberta. So I'm writing about it because I think this is stuff that we see statistically as Canadians. We read about it in the paper in terms of, you know, the odd political, you know, protesting one way or the other. But I think many of us don't really get a glimpse of it in its real life. And then, of course, I'm just writing fiction, but I'm still trying to get us to see the insides of, a file involving a First Nations person.
The book also talks about the sort of resistance movement, the anti-development folks and the sort. What do you want to say about them and their cause, perhaps?
Yeah, what's really, to me, what became interesting about that, like inadvertently, like I'm saying unintentionally on my part, was the Occupy movement that took place, like I think starting in New York and then kind of swept across North America and other places that eventually ended up on the lawns of the Art Gallery in Vancouver. That happened about 2 years into me writing this story, if not three. I'd created my own fictional version of that. Like I'd imagined one where these East Van, you know, kind of left-wing radicals, you know, ecologically minded youngsters, kind of through legitimate means they acquire some property in Shaughnessy in my story, and I wanted to put them there to have this, you know, contrast between Shaughnessy and then these young radical kids. And but it was, to me, really interesting that while long after I'd written that, that we suddenly had an Occupy movement that was very much a similar type of thing. And I think I was just wanting to kind of give some, kind of hesitant to use the word voice, but to give some, yeah, maybe that is the best word, to give some kind of voice to the East End, you know, the commercial drive, the young kids that are in the critical mass ride that are, you know, trying to make their, you know, stake some political ground one way or the other, and so that I just wanted to, in a sense, in a somewhat, you know, light way or entertaining way, to have them meet the kind of more traditional conservative moneyed powers that be, and getting into civil litigation with it. So that's all. I'm just wanting to my politics, like on an individual level, they are not cut and dry. Like if someone was to try to pin me on the left or the right, they would just never be able to do that because I'd like to think outside those boxes on a categorical basis. So when I'm showing the right and when I'm showing the left, I'm showing all this tension, but I'm trying not to fall one way or the other because I definitely have strong support for many of those bicycling young people that I put into the story. But by the same token, I'm not entirely sure that I would say that what they themselves are promoting is necessarily the way that we should be doing politics or, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, my story is very much inspired just by economics, and I'm not a formally trained economist, but it's one discipline that fascinates me as much as many others. And so I'm really trying to explore much of these issues just from pure economic theory and that type of thing.
You know, that's the thing about living in the city. It can be expensive. It's often frustrating. But, I mean, it's a pretty good place, isn't it? I mean, otherwise we wouldn't live here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean as much as I tend to have fun with Vancouver in both my writings, in this one and To See the Sky, you know, which were us kind of satirizing the Olympics.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no question. I mean, for me, I guess I wished it didn't rain quite so much, but it didn't last December, so that's a bit of a problem. But its beauty is just I suggest to ask any Canadian from any other city to say that this is not an incredibly beautiful city, especially in the summer, to bike around and have mountains and ocean. Absolutely, and it is unfortunate that it is here, but I mean, I don't think it's, I mean, it's like going anywhere else. Go to France, go to, you know, you live in some of those places on the water, and it's equally expensive. So yes, I don't know what one really does about that.
And no matter where you live, like I'm in the Fraser and King Edward area.
Yeah. Yes.
And then, you know, I have friends all over the city. Yeah. And we all think that wherever we live is the best place, right?
Yes. Yeah, it is. And I kind of live off of Main and Broadway and very, very central. And I didn't used to live in this area. And I've only lived here now for a couple of years. And I can say that I've enjoyed somehow life in Vancouver a lot more since kind of living in this neighborhood. I find it a very vibrant neighborhood, and it's in terms of its centrality and in terms of its kind of demographics. I think it's a wonderful neighborhood.
What do you get out of writing fiction? I mean, you could easily write, say, a nonfiction book or an op-ed in a newspaper or a column or a blog. But it seems to me that you as a writer go somewhere else when you're writing fiction, and I'm wondering, what do you find that experience like?
Well, it's very important to me, I think, to kind of, in terms of being different, writing fiction than nonfiction. And I think before I began to write To See the Sky, like, I mean, which came out, like, say, 2007 or so, or 2008, I can't remember, but I think I probably made some kind of categorical conscious decision that I've been writing nonfiction for a long time. I've published, numerous law journal articles, and I think there was just some sense that, you know, apart from those being circulated among academics and that kind of thing, and researchers, is that I really did genuinely want to be able to express my same kind of intellectual interest, analyze the similar, say, social issues that I'm interested in, but through fiction and creativity and by having my own kind of my own voice come through in terms of humor. Like I think that I tend to, my own sense of humor, I think, is quite, keeps me healthy in the world, in terms of, we all have our different anxieties and I think our different senses of humor pull us through and give us perspective. But when you're writing nonfiction, it tends to have to be in a fairly dry way. Like, I'm not a journalist, so I don't get to have a kind of a strong voice that people kind of begin to associate with. You write for academically, and everything's quite cut and dry. And I think I just began to feel that I'd like to introduce or inject humor and creativity and drama into the things that concern me. And so I treat my fiction writing as on some level is no different than my nonfiction, in terms of I'm just simply trying to communicate, get ideas out to readers, and they can do with them what they like, just as they do with nonfiction. They can agree or disagree, or they can argue about it, and that's fine. But with fiction, it's like there's no rule suddenly for how you get to present the information, and I really, really like that, just in the same way that, you know, I've taught myself to paint, and I don't have any rules about it. I just paint, and so that's really the main reason. I don't think I've abandoned nonfiction for good by any means. I've taken up an interest lately in kind of drug policy, and I'm kind of I've got at least on the back burner, you know, an article that I'll try to get out some at some point on that. But fiction is just far more freer in its form. And
yeah, well, I'm looking forward to reading this book, finishing it certainly, and best of luck with it. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Joseph. Thank you.
You're very welcome. ChristopherNolan.com is the website for more. The book is called Tough Tiddlywinks. It's published by A Picture's Worth Press, and you can pick that up at Chris's Pulp Fiction Books there on Main. Christopher Nolan, the author of this book, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.